Well, first of all, let me say it's a pleasure to be back on the campus of Michigan State University, and especially to be introduced by an old friend, Bob Carr. I had some sense of regret about the outcome of the election in terms of my own race, but I felt even worse about the younger people who went down on November 4th, and none more so than Bob Carr. He was so highly regarded in Washington by his colleagues in the Congress and by the national press and others who watch us very closely, and it's my own hope that he'll be back in the running again before very long. So, I would like to say to any of you who are here tonight who may have been involved in that 1972 effort that since this is my first appearance here since that time, that I'm still grateful to all of you who stood with me. We didn't prevail, but I want to say to Bob Carr, if he doesn't already know this, that there are some things that can happen to you in politics, which I learned in 1972, that are even worse than losing an election. By that, I mean to say that I would much rather be here in East Lansing tonight with all of you as the loser of 1972 than to trade places with the man who scored that landslide victory. Beyond that, I have observed that along with the obvious disadvantages, there are some advantages in losing an election. And one is that it gives you a little more time and opportunity to reflect on the problems that face the country, and perhaps even a little more time to think about your own life and where you're going and what is important. But in any event, I have thought for some months that there are forces loose in American politics and in American society that ought to be of concern to liberals and conservatives and those in the middle alike. It isn't just that a number of the most respected and talented members of the Congress went down to defeat on November 4th, although when you look at the some of the people who replaced them, that in itself is a challenge. But what I see happening in this country is more than simply a swing to a more conservative stance. I see the substitution of a kind of unthinking emotionalism and very cleverly marketed extremism, the emergence of these new single-issue fanatical groups who will ignore a lifetime of public service if you don't agree with them on one particular issue that they're totally obsessed with. And I think that is a threat not simply to liberal politicians. It isn't that that liberalism is on the wane so much that worries me, although that's something that has to be dealt with, as it is the irrational forces that I think jeopardize a sane political process for all of us, conservatives and liberals alike. Consider, for example, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. Now, here was a perfectly valid common sense arrangement under which the two superpowers, having achieved the capability of pulverizing each other many times over, no matter which one's worst, decided that in view of the enormous cost and the danger of continuing this arms race and the piling on of more and more overkill, that it probably made sense to make a deal that neither side would build beyond a certain point. Now, that was an arrangement that was negotiated by President Ford of this state over a long period of time. And we had it almost ready for ratification in 1976 when a political judgment was made to withdraw the treaty because of the pressure from candidate Reagan. Then President Carter, I think another moderate, if not conservative, president, continued to refine and perfect and to remove some of the objections that had been raised to the treaty. And again, with the emergence of another presidential race in 1980, this treaty that was ready to go 6 years ago was set aside again. And so we read in the press the last few days that while every other part of the budget is going to be cut, education, nutrition, the environment, transportation, energy, all these other things, that we're going to have to increase the military outlays, I suppose in part because of this escalating nuclear race that now is out of control on both sides. The outgoing ambassador to the Soviet Union from the United States, a longtime president and chairman of the IBM Corporation, Thomas Watson, said on Issues and Answers about 30 days ago that unless the United States and the Soviet Union soon ratify a nuclear arms treaty, then they're bound to destroy each other in the next two or three decades. And no one will accuse Tom Watson of being a left-wing advocate or being unaware of the Soviet challenge, but a realistic businessman who has looked very closely at the implications of an uncontrolled nuclear race and has decided if it is continued, it will either bankrupt us economically or, as he said, more seriously, end up destroying much of the world. To me, that is one issue that has been so clouded with falsehood and emotionalism, if not paranoia, that I'm concerned about it, not as a liberal, but as an American, and as a father, as a human being. Consider as a second example of irrationalism in contemporary politics this absurd fact that a simply stated amendment to the Constitution ensuring at long last equal rights to the more than half of our population who are women, that amendment has been unable to secure political support necessary for ratification. I remember years ago when that amendment first surfaced, I thought it would go through without very much conflict and debate. And one has to ask in 1981 how any reasonable person who believes in equality of opportunity can deny the constitutional affirmation of equal rights for the more than 50% of the people of this country who happen to be women. Consider as a third example the continuing furor in recent Senate races, not so much in the House since they didn't have to vote directly on this issue, the ratification of the Panama Canal Treaty. Now that prudent and historically essential treaty was negotiated and supported by the last four presidents of the United States, two Democrats, two Republicans. It had the support of all of the Joint Chiefs, even more enthusiastically than they supported the SALT Treaty, although they supported both of them. It had the clear support of the Republican leader of the Senate as well as the Democratic leader, some 68 senators in all, and yet it is an uncomfortable fact of life that some of the best members of the United States Senate were defeated in 1978 and others in 1980 on the basis of that one issue. I think there's no question that Senator Church, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who lost by a narrow margin, went down to defeat on the Panama Canal Treaty, which he managed on the Senate floor. Then one final example of the kind of dangerous distortions and emotionalism that I'm talking about are the numbers of people who went down to defeat last November and some in 1978 because they refused to yield to somebody's doctrinaire version of safeguarding the family. It is said, for example, that the family is threatened unless the Congress of the United States will approve an amendment under which the government supervises every pregnancy to make sure that nobody ever has an abortion, no matter what the circumstances. I do not understand allegedly conservative people who talk about getting Uncle Sam off our backs, who want to invite him into the bedroom to But I found myself being labeled in this last campaign in hundreds of thousands of pamphlets and flyers that were widely circulated across the state as the anti-family candidate, and my opponent as the pro-family candidate, this notwithstanding the fact that I'm the father of five children, and I've been married to the same woman for 37 years, for which she deserves the Distinguished Service Medal, putting up with a public figure all those years. Nonetheless, I end up labeled the anti-family candidate, and I was running against a 57-year-old bachelor. So this is the kind of thing that that concerns. I don't want to leave the implication I'm putting down bachelors here tonight. I just don't think they deserve the pro-families label that my opponent got. But so many of these symbols have been manipulated in such a way as to influence the outcome of important congressional races, which in itself is a threat, but also it diverts our attention from a serious and thoughtful examination of what, for example, we could do in this country to really strengthen families. I'm not against that. If there's certain steps we can take through the tax laws and through our social services and economic policy to strengthen family life, I would think that a worthy investment of public energy and public resources. We saw in the 1960s, how the issue of how the symbol of the flag, which all of us honor, was taken over largely by right-wing militaristic elements. If you were against the war, you ended up wearing a dove or an olive branch or something of that kind. It's a perfectly fine symbol. But the people who were for the war, even at a time when it was clear to just about everybody that it was just ruining this country, to say nothing of what it was doing to the people of Southeast Asia, they took over the flag, and they started wearing that little American flag in their lapels. The question I would ask here tonight is why we should let those who support a mistaken military course claim a monopoly on the American flag. I think it's important for people who stand for peace and for a rational foreign policy, and who, for example, right now deplore what looks like the beginning of a serious blunder in El Salvador, where I find it almost impossible to believe what we're doing. With a new administration in office, General Haig in the State Department, and President Reagan, sending off helicopters, automatic weapons, and American military advisors to yet another revolutionary struggle in another primitive and impoverished country. It may be somewhat different from Vietnam. Obviously, it's much closer. It probably is one where we could score a military victory for whatever that proves. But what have we really demonstrated in sending American military personnel and lethal weapons into a situation of that kind to try to smash a band of dissident revolutionaries? We're told it includes elements of the Catholic Church, students and journalists and peasants. Some of them may be wrong, maybe some of them are right. In any event, it's another one of those confusing and ambiguous circumstances where it's very difficult for a great outside power like the United States to do anything other than to offer its services to try to mediate the conflict. And this is what this is the paradox of the whole thing. The president of El Salvador has said he doesn't need our military help, that what he needs is some economic assistance and he'll handle the guerrillas. And then he's asked for our assistance in negotiating an end to the struggle. So we read yesterday where the helicopters and the advisors are going down, and today we read where the president of El Salvador is going to leave for Germany this weekend to see if he can get some help in Germany in negotiating an end to the war. Why don't we play that role as the mediator and the peacemaker and the honest broker instead of going down this path again of a kind of a macho Hollywood military intervention? Now, in any event, before I got diverted by El Salvador, I was starting to say that in the 1960s, the right wing took over the flag. In the 1970s, they took over the family. And now in the 1980s, they want to take over God. And so we have the emergence of this so-called moral majority, which claims to judge all the rest of us on the basis of where we stand morally on these highly complicated, largely secular issues. And I'm very much concerned that some, not by any means all, of these television evangelists with tens of millions of people following them closely on television are now moving over into the political realm with a different hat on to judge people morally on how they vote on things like the Department of Education or the Panama Canal, which are not essentially moral issues, but very complicated political and secular issues on which moral people can and do disagree. But let's just take a few minutes to take a look at these right-wing religious and quasi-religious evangelists, and I think it'll give you some idea, maybe, of what we're up against in terms of tactics. Now, the Reverend Jerry Falwell is one of them. He heads up the Old Time Gospel Hour. He has a weekly audience of 25 million people. You've got to talk to an awful lot of Michigan State universities to get to 25 million, although I must say I'm very impressed with this marvelous audience here tonight. He's on 317 television stations every week with a budget of $60 million. I don't know, I don't suppose anyone here ever looks at Penthouse magazine, but there's an interview in the current issue which my duties required that I look at, and In that interview, Reverend Falwell is asked why it takes $60 million to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he said, well, you have to keep in mind, when Jesus said, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel unto every creature, there were only 250,000 people on earth. Now there are 4 billion. It takes a lot of money to reach 4 billion souls. Well, there's probably some truth in that. Then you have Reverend Pat Robertson, who heads up the 700 Club. He's on 5 nights a week with an audience of 5 million people and 130 television stations, and he has a budget of $100 million. I must say I have great respect, if not outright envy, on the ability of these people to raise money for their cause. Just a third one, and then I won't bore you with this. The Reverend James Robeson, who heads a television program called James Robeson Presents, he has a weekly audience of 5 million people. He's on 93 television stations with a budget of 13 million. Now, these people that I refer to here are working very closely with right-wing political action groups that make no claim to being religious. But the point is, there's a close meeting of minds on the political targets, whether it's John Culver in Iowa, or Frank Church in Idaho, or Birch Bayh in Indiana, whoever you're talking about. But let me just give you a few words in their own words to give you the flavor of some of these people. And we'll begin with the non-religious groups. Here's John T. Dolan, who is the director of the National Conservative Political Action Committee. That got shorthanded, as some of you know, to the letters NCPAC. And they were the group that, beyond any others, went after me in 1980. If there was any one group that did me in, it was NCPAC. So if there are any authentic right-wingers here tonight who want to contribute to an effective group at getting rid of liberals, I suppose NCPAC is as good as any. But here is John Dolan's words in a press conference in our state. He said, there's no question about it. We're a negative organization, and we're not interested in respectability. We're going to beat these liberals and send a shiver down the spine of every senator and congressman. Now, it's interesting to me that the first organized effort among my surviving Democratic colleagues was to call a separate caucus, not the main Democratic caucus, but a separate caucus of about 15 Democratic senators to figure out a strategy to move the Democratic Party to the right. That's the shiver down the spine that Mr. Dolan is talking about. And then he goes on I'd ask you to listen to these things because it gives you some idea of tactics. He says it is images that are important in politics, not the issues. We start early and we use repetition, and if you do it long enough and intently enough, it's bound to have some impact. Start, he said, for example, with an image like George McGovern does not represent South Dakota. Keep hitting away with that night and day. That's a lot more effective than to argue about whether George McGovern has done this or done that for South Dakota. And then these interesting observations. He says, we're hoping that these negative labels will stick, although we recognize that the voters may not remember by election day why they are so upset. And then he went on to describe the strategy in our state. And I mention this not through any self-seeking here tonight, but simply because it's one that I'm familiar with, and I know it was done in many other states. They were running commercials, this one organization, NCPAC, as much as 72 times a day on radio, every 20 minutes around the clock, and television commercials running at a frequency of 200 times a week. Now, none of that was listed by my opponent as an expenditure on his part, because these right-wing groups very cleverly avoid officially endorsing anyone. But if they can demolish the incumbent candidate, that is almost the same as contributing the money to the challenger. He concluded his summary with a follow-up press conference in Salt Lake City the next day, in which he said, with the kind of tactics that we are now using, we can elect Mickey Mouse to the United States Senate. Now, some people think they did that. And one other word from the right-wing political groups. Here's Dr. Paul Weyrich, who is the director of the Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress. Just one sentence from him. He said, we're different from previous generations of conservatives in that we are no longer working to preserve the status quo. We are radicals working to overturn the present structure of this country. Now, on the religious end of it, you get a somewhat different flavor, but I think equally narrow and equally intense. And these groups have fallen into a pattern, whether you're talking about the Christian Voice or the Christian Action Coalition, whose director is also a co-founder of the Moral Majority, in which they're rating members of Congress, members of the Senate and the House, on certain selected issues. Now, no one in public office can complain about the voters examining his or her moral strength. That's a legitimate consideration. But what is happening is the questionable criteria that's being used. So they've worked out a list of 14 issues on which you're rated morally or immorally. If, for example, you voted for the Equal Rights Amendment for women, you lost 10 points on the moral scale. If you voted against an increase in military spending, you lost another 10 points. I don't know what part of the New Testament they got that out of. But if you... if you were so wicked as to vote funds for sex education, that cost you another 10 points. If you voted to create a separate Department of Education, you lost another 10 points morally. Now, it probably will come as no surprise to any of you to know that I got a zero. And I... I would imagine that Congressman Carr did too, although I don't want to put an undue burden on him. I had thought possibly they were anti-Methodist. I happen to be a Methodist, but I discovered that Father Drynan, the one Jesuit priest in the Congress, also got a zero on morals. Some of you will be cheered to know that Congressman Kelly of Florida, of Abscam fame, got 100% moral rating. And I won't go into Congressman Bauman's difficulties. In any event, it might be useful, again, to just listen to the words of these religious right-wingers. I've talked about the ones that are frankly political right-wing organizations, but there was a huge meeting that some of you doubtless read about last August in Dallas, Texas. 15,000 fundamentalist ministers who gathered there to plan their strategy for the election. Before I go any further, it might be well for me to say that I'm not against the tradition of the evangelicals. My father was an evangelical minister, but he never taught me that God was a right-wing reactionary. And I think he would have deplored some of the things that have been said in the name of the Bible, because most of these things have no biblical foundation at all. There's some right-wing politician's notion of what the Bible ought to say. But listen to the words of, for example, the Reverend Robison speaking to these 15,000 fundamentalist ministers in Dallas with candidate Reagan sitting on the stage. Reverend Robison said, "I'm sick and tired of hearing about all these radicals and perverts and liberals, all of us on the same level, I guess, and all these leftists and communists coming out of the closet. I say it's time for God's people to come out of the closet and out of the churches and change America." And then this final observation from Reverend Robison: "If necessary, I believe that God will raise up a tyrant, a man who may not have the best ethics, to protect the freedom of the ethical and the godly." Now, that's something else my father didn't teach me. And then you have the Reverend Bailey Smith, I regret to say the president of one of the largest churches in the United States, the Southern Baptist Convention, of over 13 million members, and I know that this doesn't represent the views of many of those Southern Baptists, including former President Carter. But here is what their president had to say, President Bailey Smith, in Dallas, Texas, at this same meeting. He said, "I'm telling you that all other gods beside Jehovah and his son Jesus Christ are strange gods. It's interesting to me at great political rallies how you have a Protestant to pray, and then you have a Catholic to pray, and then you have a Jew to pray. Now, with all due respects for those dear people, my friends, God Almighty does not hear the prayer of a Jew." Now, I never thought we'd hear that kind of religious and political bigotry in this country, especially before an audience of 15,000 clergymen who claim to speak for the Bible. There's no such doctrine as that in either the Old or the New Testament. This one final word from that Dallas conference, and again, this is Paul Weyrich, the head of the Committee for the Survival of a Free Congress. You notice they always have these lofty names on these miserable organizations. He said to this group of fundamentalist ministers, now one of these reporters out here that interviewed me the other day said, "Well, you know, you people think that everything is black and white, that every issue can be reduced to simplicity." And then Mr. Weyrich said, "Well, I accept that because that's exactly what I do believe." Well, it's that tendency to see all issues, no matter how complicated, as black or white, moral or immoral, that makes the moral majority and the radical right such a threat to both religion and politics. And I'm glad to note in the last few weeks that some of the evangelical ministers have themselves been speaking out against the moral majority and against this dangerous and disturbing fanaticism that threatens fairness and decency in our politics. Consider, for example, Billy Graham, who's speaking to the Conference of Religious Broadcasters, warned them that the moral majority was guilty of arrogance, that it was guilty of a kind of a narrowness of spirit and mind that was the antithesis of what Christianity and religion ought to be about. And he said, "Gentlemen, we ought to be a lot less concerned about the private sex life of individuals and more concerned about a nuclear arms race that jeopardizes all civilization." And then And if you look at the New York Times of January 29th, you'll find this quote from Dr. Billy Graham. How can we, meaning his fellow evangelicals, how can we be indifferent to the millions who live on the brink of starvation while the nations of the world are spending $550 billion each year on the weapons of war? Well, that to me is encouraging, that Dr. Graham and others who can probably speak more effectively than you or I could to these moral majority people are warning that they're headed down the path of false prophecy and false religion. Now, there's no argument here about the right of religious people to be active in politics. I tried the best I could to get church people stirred up 15 years ago on the war in Vietnam and on world hunger and issues of that kind, and I think that's all to the good. And I don't object to conservative religious people being active in politics. What I object to is the narrow criteria which takes an issue like the Department of Education and says you're immoral if you vote for that office. It may be wrong, it may be a mistake. I'm not going to argue that here, although I voted for it, but it's certainly not moral or immoral. If you want here tonight a moral report card that I think would make some sense, look at the Bible itself. If you're a Jew, look at the Old Testament prophets, where you read this: "What doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God?" Now that's a pretty good moral criteria: justice and mercy and humility and love. Those are the kind of broad spiritual qualities and insights that I think should be applied to those of us in public life, whether we're conservatives or liberals or what we claim to be. Look at the New Testament. Just a few words here, if you'll forgive me for sounding like a preacher here for a while. In the thank you. In the 25th chapter of Matthew, read these words. This is Christ speaking. "For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee and hungered and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me." Now that, again, that's the kind of moral report card I'd like to get 100% on. I hasten to add, I don't think very many of us in Congress deserve 100%. I don't think very many of us deserve a zero. Probably most of us are in a range somewhere in between. And you can't always be sure, if you're on the moral side of an issue, whether it's hunger or Vietnam or El Salvador or women's rights or whatever, you can't always be sure that you're going to have a majority. And I don't find any biblical foundation for the view that moral people always have a majority. I don't know where this moral majority claim was so, how it got so easily accepted, because this is what I read in the New Testament: "Enter ye in at the straight gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. But straight is the gate, and narrow is the way that leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. Not any moral majority there. Rather a difficult challenge that the Bible tells us a great many people will find too hard and too difficult. So I'm hopeful that when you hear these people claiming either that they're a majority or that they're moral or both, that you'll look very critically. Don't let them confuse the New Right with the New Testament. And don't assume that that people who drape themselves with a kind of religious sanctity necessarily have any better insight on the problems of the arms race and inflation and energy and all these things that disturb us than others do. It's to try to counter these simplistic approaches that has led me to form a new public interest group that we call Americans for Common Sense. I hope that doesn't sound like too lofty a title. It's not near as lofty as Moral Majority, and we're probably not as big. But it's an effort to do two things, to see if we can't build a network of people across this country who will try to counter as best they can the influence of these single-issue fanatical right-wing groups, whether doing it through radio call-ins or letters to the editor or speaking up at public gatherings or over the coffee cups or where, at least be alert to the fact that there are other people working very hard to impose a kind of a narrow fanatical framework of positions on this country. And then the second thing we want to do is to go beyond that, to see if we can't think through more acceptable and practical answers to the real problems that face the country. I would put the nuclear arms race number one on my agenda. I think Bob Carr would too, bringing this terribly costly arms race and terribly dangerous arms race under control. If you're not interested in the peace aspects of it or the survival aspects, then look at the economic cost of putting $230 billion a year into armaments. We want to spend what is necessary. No one's suggesting that we be weak militarily, but we also want to apply a critical approach to those defense issues to make sure that we're not needlessly spending for armaments what is so urgently needed in other areas of our national life. We want to look at that problem, at the issues of inflation, which nobody seems to have an easy answer to, the problems of financing education in this country, and every student here knows how that's escalating and the difficulties of financing good education, the question of protecting our physical environment, trying to develop an alternative energy strategy. These are all the issues that we hope to try to approach with a common sense perspective that will not only help us better to combat the challenge of the new right, but also fulfill the task of a major political movement, which is to come to grips with the real problems before the country. In any event, the purpose of all of this is to continue an effort that I've been involved in for a great many years, and that's to do what one person can to try to help this country move closer to the kind of great and good land it can be when it's faithful to the ideals with which we began. Thank you very much for your... Thank you.